History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. In 1911, some of the greatest minds in science convened at the first Solvay Conference in Physics, a meeting that was absolutely unprecedented. Almost half of the attendees had won or would go on to win the Nobel Prize. Over the course of those few days, these minds began to realize that classical physics was about to give way to quantum theory, a tectonic shift in our history and how we understand not just our world, but the universe. At the center of this meeting were Marie Curie, already a Nobel laureate, and a young Albert Einstein. In the years preceding, Curie had faced the death of her husband and soulmate, Pierre. She was on the cusp of being awarded her second Nobel Prize, but scandal erupted all around her when the French press revealed that she was having an affair with a fellow scientist, Paul Langevin. The subject of vicious attacks in the French press, Curie found herself in a storm that threatened her scientific legacy. Albert Einstein, already showing flourishes of his enormous genius, proved a support in her troubles. They had an instant connection at Solvay. Curie had been responsible for one of the greatest discoveries in modern science, radioactivity, but still faced resistance and scorn. Einstein recognized this injustice, and their mutual admiration and respect, born out of this first meeting, will go on to serve them in their paths forward to make history. Today's guest, Jeffrey Orens, author of the new book, The Soul of Genius, describes Curie and Einstein's relationship and uses never-before-seen correspondence and notes, revealing the human side of these brilliant scientists. One who pushed boundaries and demanded equality in the largely male-dominated scientific world, and the other who is destined to become synonymous with genius. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Jeffrey Orens. Jeff, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here, Scott. Thanks for inviting me.
I always like to learn about figures that I have superficial knowledge of, and that's why I'm entering this discussion. I am no means an expert on Albert Einstein and Marie Curie, and I only have layman's knowledge on them. And I know about them, but I've literally, until I saw your book, never put them together. So what was the initial insight and the spark that made you realize their friendship was more important than most historians of science think of and deserves an entire book on the subject?
Well, the idea that these two got together isn't so much the focus of the book as the idea that genius in all of its forms, men as well as women internationally, different countries in Europe, got together at a unique forum called the Solvay Conference to discuss topics that were of burning interest to the world of physics at that time. In 1911, when Marie Curie and Albert Einstein attended the first Solvay Conference in Brussels, at the request of Ernest Solvay, who had invited a small elite group of physicists and chemists to get together to talk about the earth-shattering ideas of quantum theory and how that was shaking the foundations of the physics world, which had been built 250 years before by Newton and his theories on gravity and laws of motion and theories of light. The idea that these people would get together and share their insights so that they could debate and discuss in a manner that was very unusual at the time, was something that was of interest to me to begin with. When I saw that Marie Curie and Albert Einstein both were at the conference, I learned a little bit more about their interaction and how they became friends and really weren't scientific peers who were sharing scientific insights as much as people who supported each other throughout the remainder of their friendship. So it was an interesting combination of scientific discussion at the Solvay Conference, but built on top of that, a friendship that Marie Curie's daughter, Eve Curie, describes as loyal and supportive. And that type of friendship was something that I hadn't really thought about in terms of seeing the names of Marie Curie and Albert Einstein next to each other in a conference photo as an example.
Well, I'd love to hear about Marie Curie's and Pierre's, her husband's background. leading up to this conference, as I was preparing for this interview and looking at your book, reading some background about her, I began with really knowing the only two facts that most people could claim if you just asked someone off the street, who's Marie Curie? And they'd say, she did something with radiation. I can't really say what. And didn't she die of it? I think I saw an internet meme about irony. Those are basically the two facts that people know. But what stuck out to me is, number one, the Curies were very hard scrabble. They were basically working out of a shed and didn't even have an assistant until after winning the Nobel Prize. So that's some guerrilla science right there. And Marie's fiercely proud Polish identity, despite doing much of her work in France. Polonium is named after that. A lot of really interesting facts. But can you tell me about their background leading up to their shared Nobel Prize and then up to this conference as well?
Absolutely. So Marie Curie from Poland, as you mentioned, basically grew up in a family atmosphere where her parents were both educators and both staunchly supportive of education for women as well as men. So already something different in the world of science, if not the general world, supporting women and their education. She could only go so far for education. She lived in Poland, which was ruled by the Russians at that time. They did not allow women to go to universities. And so through her hard work and effort, she and a sister earned enough money to support each other going to the Sorbonne, which was their lifelong dream to go to the Sorbonne in Paris and get an education there. So Marie worked as a governess and sent money to her sister, who became a doctor. And then the sister sent money for Marie to come to Paris and become educated as a physicist and a mathematician. Marie was extremely bright, and she thirsted for education on a continual basis. And as she went through her courses in the Sorbonne, which she loved every aspect of, she centered on physics as an area that seemed very interesting to her. And through an introduction, through some friends, she met Pierre. Now, Pierre was over a decade older than Marie. So she was in her 20s. He was in his mid-30s. But they met related to a mutual interest in a particular area of physics, that of magnetism. So you might say they were magnetically attracted in more ways than one. But the idea of discussing magnetism, Marie was doing a research project at the time on magnetism related to different steel. And Pierre was basically an expert in magnetism already, as well as being an expert in a number of other physics areas.
Well, I'd love to hear about Marie and Pierre's background. If you ask a person on the street about Marie Curie, they typically only know two things: that she had something to do with radiation, although most people wouldn't be able to describe what. I really wouldn't be able to very well either. And she ironically died of it. So that's a little factoid that has eclipsed many of her significant achievements. But what interested me when I learned about her background is that for many years, Marie and Pierre were very hard scrabble when it came to science. They didn't even have an assistant until after they won the Nobel Prize. They were doing experiments out of their shed and really doing guerrilla science that revolutionized their field. And also, Marie was fiercely proud of her Polish background. So could you tell me about their scientific career and important facts leading up to 1903 and then later on to this conference in 1911?
Absolutely. So Marie, as you mentioned, was from Poland. She came from a family of educators. Both her mother and father were educators and thought very highly of education for both men and women. And that was certainly unusual for the time period, not only in Poland, but across most of the world. So Marie was an extremely bright individual. And in her studies, she could only go so far in Poland. Poland was run by Russian occupiers, and they strictly prohibited Polish women from university education. And so she and her sister both wanted to aspire to higher education. They both wanted to go to the prestigious university, the Sorbonne in Paris, to study. And so they devised a scheme where they both earned money. One would earn money and send the other to the Sorbonne. That turned out to be Marie becoming a governess and sending her sister to the Sorbonne, and the sister became a doctor. Then turnabout fair play, and the doctor financed the education for Marie to come to the Sorbonne. She studied there. Marie studied both physics and mathematics, and she got a master's degree in both. And she loved her time at the Sorbonne and the education that she derived from that institution. She started to work on a project in magnetism. One of her professors had connected her with an institution that was looking to study magnetism with various steels. She was doing that when she met, through mutual acquaintances, Pierre, who happened to be an expert in magnetism. So the two of them shared their insights in magnetism, but also were discussing science on an equal-to-equal level. And both of them found this exhilarating, especially Pierre, who had, before this time, not thought of moving forward from a romantic standpoint, basically devoting his life to science. He had found someone in Marie who also wanted to devote her life to science. So both of them had this mutual attraction, this magnetism, not only related to study, but related to each other. And over the course of the next year, as they became closer, Pierre wanted them to share their lives together in marriage. Marie was hesitant. She thought she might want to go back to Poland and help educate her compatriots and bring their education to a certain level, because she, as you mentioned, was a fierce nationalist and wanted only the best for her Polish brethren. But Pierre convinced her to stay in Paris. They got married. They started to work on a project for Marie to become to give her doctoral dissertation in a suitable area. And as they started to look around at that time, in 1895, Wilhelm Röntgen had discovered X-rays. And shortly after, a prestigious French scientist, Henri Becquerel, had looked into mysterious rays that were being transmitted from the element uranium. He found that they weren't quite as strong as X-rays, but they were of interest. He gave some papers on his findings to the French Academy of Sciences, and then left that and moved on to other subjects. Marie picked up on that, the work that Becquerel had done on what were called then Becquerel rays, or these mysterious rays from uranium. She felt that this would make a great dissertation for her doctorate in physics to explore these rays, mysterious rays, in further detail. And so with the help of Pierre, who was also interested in this type of work, together, as you mentioned, they worked in a closely cramped quarters setup in a shed, if you will, with some scientific equipment and the love of science. And they started to do explorations, first Marie herself. And as she started to explore these uranium emissions, she started to take a look at other elements and minerals that might, perchance, give similar emissions. She came across some minerals, one of which was called pitchblende, that contained uranium. But mysteriously, as she was exploring the rays that were emitted by this pitchblende, as she extracted uranium, the uranium that was in the pitchblende, and was left just with pitchblende residues, the pitchblende residues had even more emissions than the original uranium. Now, they measured these emissions as electronic emissions that caused ionization, if you will, in the atmosphere. Basically, these emissions causing electrons to be emitted from the atmosphere because of the radiation that was being given off by these substances. When she found that these substances that were left in the residues of pitchblende after uranium was extracted
gave off more emissions than uranium, she was tremendously excited. She was moving down a path to the discovery first of polonium, and then shortly after, radium. Those two elements were discovered by Marie Curie with the help of Pierre to a certain extent, but initially by Marie's own efforts. And that led to basically both of them being awarded in 1903, along with Henri Becquerel. They were all three awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics for the discovery of radioactivity. That in and of itself was a monumental achievement, and one that many thought, well, this was Pierre Curie's work, and maybe Marie was his able assistant, but how could a woman do that type of work? This must be Pierre Curie's effort. Well, as it turned out, over the course of the next number of years, few things happened. Pierre Curie passed away in 1906, so a few years after the awarding of the Nobel Prize. He was in his mid-40s, and he died in a horrible horse cart accident where he was run over. And Marie Curie was distraught for a number of years, losing this person who had worked so closely with her and who was linked to her not only professionally, but so tightly personally. They had two daughters together, and now she was left with the memories of Pierre, and unfortunately, a situation where she was not really viewed as the genius that she was because of her discoveries, which might have been more credited to Pierre than her. So it was a time that was unsettling for her. Well, over the next number of years, she resolutely did her work related to understanding more about radium and polonium and radioactivity and how these materials could be used. And she became recognized as an expert, in fact, the expert in the field of radioactivity. And by 1911, when she attended this conference, the Solvay conference was all about subatomic machinations and the subatomic universe and how it had turned classical physics upside down. And she fit right in with understanding those particulars. And so the conference for her was probably was a time when she was at her height of fame related to radioactivity. And then on top of that, at the conference, she received word that she was going to be awarded a second Nobel Prize, specifically for the isolation of polonium and radium as chemical elements, new elements. So she was going to be awarded a Nobel Prize in chemistry. And that would bookend her Nobel Prize in physics, which she had received along with Pierre. And things at the conference were, to her, moving along in a tremendously euphoric fashion until at the end of the conference, an affair was exposed, an affair between her and another French scientist who was also at the conference, Paul Langevin. They had, in a clandestine manner, been seeing each other for a couple of years. Marie had been a widow as of 1906. So when she started intimately having a relationship with Paul Langevin in 1909, 1910, which was exposed in 1911, this was something that had been ongoing for a time. And the French press crucified her for it, although they didn't crucify Paul Langevin to the extent that they went after Marie, which basically showed the misogynistic nature of not only the French press, but society in general.
Yeah, a couple of things with that. This is a bit of an aside, but when you mentioned earlier that prior to winning the Nobel Prize with their research on radioactivity, which was basically done out of a shed in their house, it's really amazing how different science was a century ago when today research on nuclear fusion is done by the ITER laboratory, this multinational collaboration spending billions and billions of dollars for this fusion ignition factory, something that couldn't be done in a shed. But you can see that difference, for example, in how one could read about science a century ago when an educated man or woman could read Christian Huygens' Treatise on Light or Copernicus without really knowing the science. But today, you couldn't really go into JSTOR and read treatises on science without being a specialist. You have to read popular science, like Popular Science Magazine. So that's a change. But getting back to Marie Curie, here's what I'm curious about. How would she appear to the French public? Because as you said, she's of Polish background. She really bootstrapped her way up. She was not of an elite background whatsoever, had to work as a governess. A lot of prominent scientists at this time, like Niels Bohr from Denmark, came from an elite background. So for her, who's more like a Thomas Edison, who is self-taught, bootstraps her way up, would she appear as some people would think uncouth? She has a foreign accent, or how would the French public receive her, even though she, in one sense, should be kind of the pride of France because she's a woman who wins a Nobel Prize. She's progressive in the early 20th century sense. So how is she perceived even before this scandal breaks out?
Yeah, it was an unsteady situation for her throughout her time in France. Unsteady in terms of being perceived as certainly a genius for the work that she had accomplished, both in winning her Nobel Prize in 1903 and winning her second Nobel Prize in 1911. But remember, as you describe it, science at that time was very much an individual type approach by many of the physicists and chemists versus the huge either think tanks of research or industrialized scientific approaches that take place today. And so back then, in the turn of the century, late 1890s, early 1900s, individuals like Pierre Curie and Wilhelm Rankine and Max Planck and a handful of others were known as individuals who furthered the cause of science. And women were thought of as, at best, able-bodied supporters of the men who were making discoveries, but not nearly on the same level intellectually. In fact, a generation before, Charles Darwin had basically said, women just weren't of the same intellectual stature as men. They couldn't be. It was biologically not that way. And so there was an inbred understanding that women were not of the same level thinkers as men. On top of that, Marie, coming from Poland, when the French press crucified her for her liaison with Paul Langevin, being a Polish interloper in France was one of the smears that they tarred and feathered her with. She's a foreigner, although she had spent a significant amount of time when she was at the Sorbonne perfecting her French accent so that she would not sound like a foreigner. And she did a great job of it. She spoke flawless French. And so the idea that she was adopting France as her homeland, in addition to being Polish, was something that she always was proud of and always touted whenever she could in subtle ways related to perfect French and related to understanding the subtleties of French culture. But at the same time, she was never accepted as a French woman per se when it was convenient. Another case in point was the year before the Salve conference, she applied for the Academy of Sciences to have a seat there in that august all-male body. And she was immediately attacked by the conservative French press, not only because she was a woman, but she was Polish. How could a Polish woman be involved in something like this? And taking a look at her credentials, well, they obviously must have been supported by working with the illustrious Pierre Curie. And so when it was convenient, the French would tar and feather her with a xenophobic take on things, as well as misogynistic. And when it was convenient, they would embrace her as one of their own. Look at what we, the French, have done in the scientific community. So it was a give and take that was very uncomfortable for her over her lifetime.
And I understand the French also claimed that she was Jewish or line of anti-Semitic attacks against her.
Yes.
As far as I know, she wasn't. So
that's correct. She was not.
So where did this line come from?
Oh, basically, the anti-Semitic trope is one that's brought out whenever it's convenient related to a smear campaign. Mm-hmm. The smear campaign related to Marie Curie not being qualified to be to gain a seat in the Academy of Sciences or not being worthy of a second Nobel Prize, those types of things. It was easy to take out behind the back type of sneer. Yes, and don't you know she's Jewish? Didn't matter if it was right or wrong, correct or incorrect. It was used by the ultra-conservative French press, and it appealed to anti-Semitism that was ingrained to a certain extent in much of Europe. Now, in France in particular, the Dreyfus Affair in the mid-1890s, when a French army captain, Alfred Dreyfus, was convicted of being a spy for the Germans, Alfred Dreyfus was Jewish. So not only was he a spy, but he was Jewish. Oh, my God, the combination. This guy needs to be sent to prison for life. And he was. Unfortunately, for justice, that was not the case. He was not a spy. And it took over 10 years for him to be finally released from his prison sentence when new evidence came out that he was not a spy. But the stigma of attaching a Jewish moniker on an individual was always convenient for a society if they were trying to besmirch the reputation of an individual.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Well, bringing in the other character in this work, Einstein, of course, that's who is Jewish. He'll have to struggle with this, the type of discrimination he faces as well. So to tell Einstein's side of the story, this is in 1911, 6 years after his Annus Mirabilis of 1905. He publishes four papers in 1 year that completely rewrite fundamental understandings of space, time, mass, and energy. But I spoke to another guest on this podcast who made the point that his theories took a while to be universally accepted. I just assumed that physics flipped on its head at this time, but it really wasn't until about 1919 when a solar eclipse happened and his theories proved demonstrably that they were correct and classical physics couldn't account for the phenomena taking place. But where was Einstein in his career at this point in 1911?
Einstein was just starting to become an individual that was known outside the German-speaking physicist world. He was 32 years old. He had published his papers in 1905 at the ripe old age of 26. And so here he was 6 years later, and people outside of Germany, Austria-Hungary, he was a pretty obscure professor at the University of Prague in Austria, or Austria-Hungary, the country. So he was known to some, but not to all. And in fact, at the time of the conference, he was hardly known to the French contingent who was there. Five French scientists, Marie Curie, one of them, really didn't know them, with the exception of Paul Langevin, who knew of and actually followed Einstein through most of his career. And so the idea of Einstein being at this conference was his, I call it his debutante ball, right? It was his coming out party related to the rest of the scientific elite who were at this conference, seeing the marvelous intelligence that Einstein exhibited as he discussed quantum theory and the photoelectric effect and how this juxtaposed against classic Newtonian theory and how there were fissures being embedded in the bedrock of physics because of the things that Einstein and a few others were thinking about quantum theory. So this was his time to become known by others. And in fact, this was one of the reasons that I say this was a meeting that changed the course of science. It changed Einstein's trajectory from an obscure professor of physics in Prague. He became known to the rest of this elite physics assembly. Marie Curie herself wrote a letter a month later to the Polytechnic University in Zurich, where Einstein wanted to move to from Prague. And the letter was glowing, praising his intelligence, his ability to put together facts in novel ways and understand the workings of physics. And so that type of interaction was vital for him. Max Planck and Walter Nernst, who were both German physicists of the highest order, saw Einstein as someone they wanted to come to Berlin in order to continue his work and bring glory to the German Republic. And so a few years after he went to Zurich, they constructed an offer and stole him away from Zurich and brought him to Berlin and gave him a situation that was too good to pass up. Basically, he was made a professor and he had no teaching duties. He could devote all his time to research, which is exactly what they wanted. And the time he devoted to research developed into, as you described, the general theory of relativity that was to become so well known in 1919 and 1920. So the idea that he was just at the beginning of his fame, if you will, within the physics community in 1911, turned into a very steep upward trajectory for him over the course of the next few years that brought him to Berlin, and his worldwide fame shortly followed. So that's one of the reasons this meeting I view as changing the course of science. It certainly changed Einstein's exposure to the world, and that in and of itself was important. But the other thing that was important at that meeting was the debate on quantum theory that basically he and Max Planck led. They were the ones who had thought about quantum theory, the idea that energy existed in discrete packets as part of light. Light was considered a wave until their theories postulated that discrete packets of energy in light called quanta would be another way that light could exist. And that was so different from classical physics. So these two ideas in terms of quantum theory being debated at the Solvay conference and Einstein's debut to a larger group of select intellectual geniuses were two major points about the conference itself that really say the course of science moved in a different direction because of that meeting.
I'd like to take a brief tangent just to talk about this conference and the role of science and empirical data to influence people's perspectives, because I think this has a lot to do with 2021, especially public policy debates about coronavirus, where many people will say, follow the science. Science suggests this different protocol, social distancing, face masks. And then people on the complete opposite side will say, science says lockdowns are a mistake. Look at Sweden. Look at all these different factors that show it hasn't worked. And to highlight how strange this argument has become, a few weeks ago, recording in May 2021, there was a dust up on Twitter where Neil deGrasse Tyson said, the good thing about science is that it's true whether or not you believe in it. And the account for Steakums, the snack food that's kind of like Combos or Oh Boy Oberto, some intern responded to Neil deGrasse Tyson, nope, science itself isn't true. It's a constantly refining process used to uncover truths based in material reality. And that process is still full of mistakes. Neil just posts ridiculous sound bites like this for clout, and he has no respect for epistemology. All right, Steakums is throwing itself in. But anyway, listeners are probably wondering, all right, where is he going with this? My point is that in 1911, you have the most brilliant minds in the world converging on one conference, and you have sort of the Young Turk vanguard, Einstein, Marie Curie are here, showing evidence, scientific-based evidence, that the entire model of physics needs to be turned on its head. But then on the other side, I'm sure you have whole guards of classical physicists who've devoted years and their entire careers to a model that really threatens their careers in a way, and all the research and the theories they've done, if this is true. And the philosopher of science, Karl Popper, once made the point that at a certain point, and I'm paraphrasing very loosely here, but you can't really convince people to change their minds at a certain point. You simply have to affect education and then educate the next generation to believe something, because some people are non-logically, perhaps emotionally attached to a theory, no matter how brilliant they are, that they really can't be convinced. So based on your study of this conference, what do you make of this? And when we say follow the science, can that really work for people, no matter how brilliant they are, based on what you see here?
I think it's a good question. The point of following the science, to me, doesn't say that things change on a dime, that there's an immediate about face based on new evidence. And the reason I put it that way is, take Copernicus, who is the father of modern science as we know it. Copernicus, on his deathbed, publishes a treatise that's called Concerning the Revolutions of Heavenly Spheres. And what it talks about is, you know how we've thought forever that the sun revolves around the earth? Well, I want to tell you, it's the exact opposite. The earth revolves around the sun, and here's why. And he goes through his proofs and his understanding and his observations, and he submits it in the most humble of manners, because he knows he's up against how many centuries of thinking in another way. But what he's done is he's proposed something out there for people to see and look at and study and hopefully develop reproducible evidence that says, you know, as I do more and more experiments and as I take more observations and as I gather more data, the Earth really is revolving around the sun. And it took hundreds of years for that to be the socially accepted, culturally accepted view of the world and the universe. Now, how does that translate through to coronavirus vaccines? It doesn't translate through well in that we don't have time for that to take place. We don't have a year or 10 years or 100 years to convince people. What we do have is science that can be put out there on a reproducible basis. Since we don't have the time, we take a lot of institutions, get as many institutions as you can to reproduce the results in a way that people can look at it and say, yes, I can see where that might be the new way of looking at things. Take a vaccine. Why? Because Pfizer, Moderna, AstraZeneca, J&J, whatever, have developed and tested as quickly as possible a part of science that we really haven't spent a lot of time on. Do we have time to convince everyone? I don't think so. If we don't have time, then you try to use as much data as you can. Copernicus was one individual, and other individuals followed over the course of years. Newton's laws of gravity and motion took 50, 75, 100 years to be inculcated into the population, such that everyone said, of course, gravity works, and here's how. We don't have that time. But Newton was one person, followed by other enlightened individuals here and there. We're talking about a mass effort here to educate people as quickly as possible that the newness of our understandings here are accurate. And here's why. Here's the data. The scientific method says you need reproducible data that you can objectively look at and say, oh, that does make sense. But at the end of the day, I believe there will always be a contingent that either doesn't believe the data or feels they have other data that's just as valid. So it's a constant effort to move in the direction of completely educating a population, at least in my view, from what I've seen in the work that I've done here in terms of understanding the changes that take place in a scientific revolution. And that's really what this is when you talk about changing the way people think. The way people think when you talk about scientists who stake their reputation on a past way of doing things, and how can they accept this new change? Well, the past way of doing things works up until a certain point. You listen to an individual named Thomas Kuhn, who is a history of science and physicist who studied The Structure of Scientific Revolution. That was his text of fame in the 1960s. And what he talks about is there comes a point when doing work and solving problems in what's, quote, normal science doesn't address all the new things that are coming up in new research, in new observations of what's happening in the universe. And when that happens, the weight on science is very heavy to come up with a new way of addressing those problems. And that in and of itself is a scientific revolution that changes the way scientists view how they address and solve problems. And in this quantum theory debate in 1911, what Einstein and Max Planck were proposing, what Marie Curie had proposed related to radioactivity, was a new way of looking at the universe such that people would understand it in a better way because it solved problems that were inexplicable before that.
Well, getting to the crux of your book, you mentioned that Einstein sees the way that Marie Curie is being treated in the press as an injustice. They respect each other. And from this first meeting with each other, it affects their paths forward. So can you describe this for me? And I understood you also looked at a lot of correspondence and notes. So what do you see from their first meeting and how does that influence the two of them going forward? Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Sure. The first meeting was one that was more at a distance across a table in a conference session. And then afterwards, because this conference was unique in that it had a format where everyone in the conference, since there were only 24 people, they could spend all their time together. And they were encouraged to. They had meals together. They spent after those meals in conversation and debate. This was a week immersed in these 24 elite individuals discussing the world and discussing their personal situations together. Marie Curie and Einstein talked about, let's get together and have a hiking vacation for our families. We both love to hike. Our older children do. Marie had two daughters who both liked to hike with her. Einstein had two sons, one of whom loved hiking. They arranged a vacation. They went to the Swiss Alps after the conference about a year and a half later, and they had the chance to see each other as people as well as professionals. And you know what it's like when you're able to understand a person personally as well as understand them from their professional viewpoint. It opens up a whole new facet of their being that you can connect to or not as you see fit. These two saw kindred spirits in terms of their genius. They saw not only that they had interesting and novel ideas and that they were dedicated, but they had extreme focus on getting things done. The focus in terms of not being dissuaded by other competing priorities. The idea of understanding how they worked was important, but the idea of supporting each other personally was really the bond that they developed. Marie Curie was a mathematician like no other woman at that time. She was one of the few who could understand Einstein as they were walking along a hiking trail, and he would start to talk about a thought experiment. Suppose I was in an elevator in outer space and there was no gravity, and he started to outline what would happen at that point in time. She could not only sympathize, oh, that's interesting, she could understand the thought experiment he was putting together to try to explain different natural phenomena. And that mathematical brilliance that they both shared was important, that physics brilliance that they both shared, but they both shared from that an ability to support their focus on different ways of thinking of things. They didn't influence each other's physics. they were supportive of each other as people. When Marie Curie came back to Paris, when her affair was exposed in the month of November after the Salve conference, she was being just inundated by incoming missiles from the conservative press. How could she be doing what she's doing? How could she think of having an affair with a married man who, by the way, was in an unhappy marriage and was freely saying to anyone who would listen that I want to get a divorce? How could she as a woman do this? Einstein, who had known her for all of a month, they had formed a bond such that he sent a letter to her that was a tremendous support. It basically said, don't pay any attention to this. This is going to happen. You are better than this. Stick to your principles. Do what you think is right. And whatever these people say, he described it as, it's hogwash. Leave it, he said, leave it to the reptiles to who it was designed for. And so just with a letter, she could see that he understood what she was going through. That type of interaction is much more than professional. It's a personal interaction that says, I support you as an individual. And that's the type of relationship they had throughout the remainder of their lives. When she passed away in 1934, by the way, of exposure to radiation and X-rays, because she had a project in World War I where she was involved in getting X-rays out to the front to help save soldiers who had been severely wounded by using compact X-ray equipment out on the front lines. She was exposed to all of this, and it ended up causing her death. But Einstein said at that time that if people had the resolve and had the understanding and had the focus that Marie Curie had, that perhaps the European community wouldn't be in such trouble as it is right now. Trouble being headed towards World War II and the German experience, if you will. So, you know, right up until the time she passed away, he was a supporter of hers. She was a supporter of his. They worked together in after World War I in an international committee on intellectual cooperation, trying to bring back together after the world was fractured by World War I, trying to bring back together the intellectual community of science and art and sharing experience and education related to those disciplines, and trying to mend the world from an intellectual standpoint. So I don't know if I've addressed your question quite the way you phrased it, but I think it's important to note that there's a personal connection that in this case overwhelmed the professional one.
That makes a lot of sense, because those two aren't siloed off from each other. How one handles personal matters affects how they can conduct themselves professionally. And you highlighted how that happened between the two of them. Do you see a long-term legacy with their correspondence and friendship that extends beyond their lives?
It's interesting. After Curie passed away in the mid-30s, her daughter was a Nobel Prize winner in her own right. Irène Joliot-Curie was also a researcher in radioactivity, and actually won a Nobel Prize in mid-1930s for her work, along with her husband, shades of Pierre and Marie winning as a couple. But Einstein was never close with the Curie family beyond his connection with Marie. He would occasionally meet with Irène, but there wasn't a legacy there. The real legacy wasn't between Einstein and Curie, it was Curie's family and science. Curie's family won altogether 5 Nobel Prizes. No family has ever done that, and most likely none ever will. Pierre won, she won in 1903. There's a couple of them. Irène wins in 1935. There's another there. Marie won her second Nobel Prize in 1911. There's the fourth. And her daughter, her other daughter, Eve, Marie's other daughter, actually was brilliant in the artistic side, not the scientific side. And she married an individual who was the head of UNICEF, and they were ambassadors to the world on behalf of UNICEF. And in the 1960s, UNICEF was given a prize that they both received the Nobel Prize for their work on behalf of children of the world. Again, a connection of Nobel Prize winning. So there's five Nobel Prizes, but Arendt's daughter became a physicist, a nuclear physicist. And of all things, Arendt's daughter named Elaine, she married the grandson of Paul Langevin, Marie Curie's lover in the 1910-1911 timeframe. That relationship in 1910-1911 collapsed under the pressure of the conservative press humiliating both of them. And they couldn't make that relationship last, even though they stayed friends for the rest of their lives. But their grandchildren married. So a full circle of scientific legacy, if you will. In the Curie family, Langevin's grandson was also a nuclear physicist, and Elaine and Langevin's grandson had a child who is an astrophysicist. So the idea of physics living on through the Curie line has been very, very strong. In the Einstein line, it was a different situation. Einstein became estranged with his wife and then divorced her and married his cousin. Didn't have any kids from that marriage, but he had had two boys from the previous one, and he became estranged from his sons for a while. He tried to keep up with them. One became a hydraulic engineer in the U.S. in the 1940s and 50s and tended to live his own life. The other became schizophrenic in his 20s and was institutionalized, and Einstein never saw him again after his institutionalization in the 1930s. So Einstein's life was more solitary in terms of his later years, whereas Curie's progeny carried on the august tradition of a physics education and profession.
All right. Well, there are a lot of encounters here with brilliant minds that I think a lot of people aren't aware of. And it's sort of a invisible hand, I guess, in the early 20th century that influences a lot of what happens in science and is even affecting what happens today. There's a lot more to this story. And for listeners who want to check out more, the name of the book is The Soul of Genius. Jeff, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. That is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Sumo 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dan Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group. And here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly. including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplug. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.